more holistic. It almost sounds somewhat spiritual. Science is very important. Technology is very important. Economics is important, but it's not the whole thing. The big system, each one of us has to manifest for ourselves. And it depends to some degree on our own skills, our cognitive, our emotional, our spiritual skills. And each of us will reach it to a different level. That is the eco-civilization future I'm imagining. A lot of it also needs to be fleshed out. There's not a single ecological future or a single eco-civilization out there. There are probably many of them. We need to design our own lives and our livelihoods to meet our eco-civilizational future.
My father was my best friend. When he passed away, it was like, there's no way to describe it. There's absolutely no way to describe those first moments when I realized that my father had passed away and was no more. I spoke about holding my daughter and realizing, wow, things are getting real. I have to be a father to this beautiful daughter now. My father's passing was my first get real moment. I think up until that time, it was ice cream and television. With my father's passing, I quickly had to become the breadwinner, so to speak. I had to cook on the streets of Lagos, do barbecue chicken to send my sisters to school to help us eat. My father exposed me to a world beyond the bubblegum realities that I previously occupied, and I'm still there. He still attends to my work. He still leaves in now and then to see how I'm doing.
Theology, it remains in the back of my mind every day. In fact, it's a source of inspiration for me, and it gave me values and hopes. It was not a decision to build a career, but I was led to different organizations, to different roles by choices inspired by those reflections. I'm also meditating a lot, spending times in meditation that helps me, but also it's a source of inspiration for me.
I guess to consider that we don't have free will in everything that we do runs completely counter to our own experience. It's a horrendous thing to imagine that we don't have free will in any decision. But what's quite clear, and it's not just neuroscientists who believe this, there are obviously schools of philosophy who also believe this, that actually free will is illusory, that actually none of us have free will. Now, that's not necessarily a view that I particularly buy into, but I certainly think that all of us have influences on the decisions that we make and the acts that we undertake that are entirely beyond our control.
You're right about my children. I learn more than any other thing from my children. My son, he's 7, he's autistic, and I call him my prophet for a reason, because he teaches me to meet myself in ways that are usually very stunning. I can get information from other people, I can read a book here and there, but it's very rare to come across such an embodiment of grace, possibility, and futurity, all wrapped up in a tiny 7-year-old boy's body. So my son has given me lots of gifts.
I think that what's going on in the world is very deeply worrying. You know, I worry for my children, I worry for society as a whole. I'm hoping that the pendulum will eventually swing back, you know, because that's what's happened in human history, is that the pendulum has swung from one extreme to another. But yes, it is very, very concerning indeed. I think that, you know, my upbringing was atheist, but it was in a very kind of almost Germanic Lutheran kind of view of what was right and wrong. And I think that that's very much fueled some of the life choices that I've made, very much with a view to kind of making the world a little bit better. I'm not saying that I have made the world a little bit better, but I think that that's what we should strive for, that it should be beyond personal gain and should be for making society a little bit better. And I try and do that through my work as a clinician.
We have these stories throughout human history of people making this decision to protect. And so I spent a lot of time imagining what their rules for life would be and what they would be doing in order to make sure that even if the worst came to pass and the museum itself was destroyed, that there was the knowledge of what was in the museum that could be passed on in this logbook, that could be wrapped up in oilcloth and taken on a canoe, as they do, and moved north to a place where, when things can be put back together again, that information, that knowledge, and that understanding still exists. And that as they're living there, they have a complex relationship to what's being protected, where they only use things from the collections that they absolutely have to use, and that they're trying to protect and record as much as possible. And then the relationship of those people to what it looks like to imagine a future when things can be put back together is very important. They're all trying to hold on and to gift to the next generation, even if I don't get to see it, even if I personally, your mother or father, I'm not the person who rebuilds. I'm training you for a life that imagines rebuilding, that imagines repair, that imagines human society coalescing again after the end of the world. And for me, that was incredibly important because I don't want to just tell a dystopian story where everything is terrible all the time. I want to be able to talk about what I'm afraid of happening globally, but I want to make sure that it's grounded in the reality that humans do rebuild even when the worst things happen. And we do create beloved communities in the face of incredibly stark circumstances.
Sleep is really important for memory. We think that one of the primary functions of sleep is to consolidate memories, both in terms of autobiographical memories, but also in terms of emotional memories. One of the theories about why we dream is to try and clean up our memories and rid them of their emotional content, which is why some researchers have termed REM sleep, dreaming sleep, as being overnight therapy. One of the other interesting theories about why we dream is that actually what we're doing while we're dreaming is actually tweaking our model of the world, because the brain really works not simply as an interpreter of our senses, but actually works in a rather more complicated and interesting way. It works as a prediction machine. So we expect what we're going to see, we expect what we're going to experience. And it's only when our senses are telling us something different from our expectation that we have to tweak our expectation of the world. It's difficult to do that when we're awake because we're taking in all these impulses from around us. But actually, when we're in dreaming sleep, when we're offline, that's the time to integrate our experience of the day into that model of the world that we have. And it's that sort of adjustment of how we understand the world to be that may be what's going on in REM sleep.
It might sound surprising, but our brains are not changing at all. So regardless of this huge cultural revolution, if we could go back in time 200,000 years ago to Eastern Africa where the first humans appeared, we get human brain from that time point, it would be strongly similar, if not identical, to our own brains now. I think that most of what we do on is cultural evolution and not biological evolution. So these changes in the culture are not necessarily supported by changes in the biology of our brains. And indeed, it is very relevant to think which are, in my opinion, the two most human professions. So what differences us the most, and our culture differences us the most from other primates, is one, that we generate new knowledge generation after generation, and second, that we transmit this new knowledge to the next generation, so they start from a different time point. And I think the most human professions are scientists and artists, who are in charge of generating new knowledge, and teachers and professors, who are in charge of transmitting this knowledge to other generations.
So these do provide significant inspiration. There have obviously been those individuals who have put themselves in the public eye, many writers of the kind of books that I write, many educators who have been deeply inspirational as well. I think that there is a bit of a, I don't know how much of this is central to the UK and how much of it is a worldwide problem, in that education has become much more of a business than it was when I was being educated. And it's much more of the relationship between the educator and the educatee is a little bit more transactional. It's a bit more consumerist. And I think that that's obviously good in a way because it maintains certain standards, but it's perhaps bad in other ways in that you lose the old style relationship between mentor and mentee.
I am constantly inspired by how people just want to do better by their peers, that they want to ensure that we all can live in the societies that we live in together. The kind of generosity of spirit that I encountered throughout interviewing people constantly feeds my hope, if not optimism. When we talk about the natural world, bodies of water are often where I feel most connected to nature. In Los Angeles, whenever I was able to go to the ocean, and I remember so fondly the time that I've spotted dolphins and felt quite emotional whenever I did. Here I live off the Thames River. But in Costa Rica, I was swimming off the Osa Peninsula, which is one of the most biodiverse places on Earth. I was swimming with the sea turtles and with other sea creatures. I just felt so connected to the broader natural world. It really highlighted to me the importance of policies like Costa Rica's biodiversity law that are as much about conservation as they are about seeing human communities as key parts of the ecosystems that we live in order to ensure that they last for generations of not just humans, but all life to come.
After talking to people and doing some more reflection, I think it's very clear to me that my upbringing in the church has a really outsized influence on my writing in terms of the Black oral tradition. Every Sunday of my youth, I was in a church, and I'm not necessarily overly religious now, but the music in the church and the actual sermons, the words, the actual Bible, all of these things were cataloging in many ways, right? My grandmother was very formative in my writing. She noticed very early on that I had an interest in reading and writing, and she fed me books, information, and really encouraged me in ways that I didn't really know what was happening. It's really bizarre now that I have kids and be able to see that distance and that connection between me and them, and to think about this woman and to see her connection to me and looking at this little boy who had an affinity for words. It still amazes me that she gave me so much. I was very fortunate enough to be born in the 80s during the explosion of hip hop, which was incredibly formative in my creative process. I think it's hard to really quantify what it felt like to see Black identities, masculinities, feminine identities, all of it, and everything in between, really articulated every day on a screen and on the radio in this poetic form that really spoke to us viscerally. Like, this music was produced by us and for us, and obviously it has been consumed by the world over. Now, at that nascent kind of moment when it was bubbling up, it was electric. It just felt so incredible to kind of hear people that you understood articulating your own expressions and your own feelings and where you came from. And then you grow older and you realize, oh, you know, you hear your parents' records and you hear music from the 60s and the 70s, and you go further back, and in New Orleans is huge in jazz. And so I actually played the trumpet when I was a little boy in elementary. And so music was always a part of just my understanding, the logic of music, and just being able to kind of understand celebration and reverie and culture in that way. I was so fortunate to be born in that milieu. But when it comes to writing as a professional, and as I got older and really started to understand my gifts, I always lean in on the poets. I want everything that I write to read like a prose poem. Poets are the people who always inject flair and imagination and creativity to my writing. While I often go to their poems especially, I think the sweet spot for me is poets who write prose. When I read their works, that is what I'm trying to recreate on the page, whether it's Claudia Rankine or Elizabeth Alexander or Natasha Trethewey or Hanif Abdul-Rakib. There's so many of these poets, Ocean Vuong, so many people that have influenced me in terms of the language and the lyricism. And even you just think about Baldwin and his syntax and the complex sentences that he would write and the way he was able to maneuver time to be in the present and the past and the future at once. I truly think that in many ways is unique to Black culture, but is also replicated in other cultures. And so when you think about Native American writers or Latin American writers and how they blend time. And so all of those figures really speak to me. And even one of my favorite living writers right now, I've read all of his work, is Mohsin Mohammed, Pakistani author. Really, really love how he manipulates time and language and how he infuses his own culture, but also brings everyone else in. These are just a few of, I think, the things that kind of influence the way I write and want to write and the way I want to read ultimately.
I think it's a kind of evolution of consciousness that we need to experience. I think being human allows us the ability to draw and to grow. And I feel that that is what I'm trying to argue for when I talk about embodied learning. Use your body to learn, or emotional learning, learning with passion about nature or about people or about communities. So I think what I'm trying to point out is the potential of what it means to be human in the future. Some of our humanity is going to be dominated by technology. There is no question about it. I mean, we benefit by prosthetic devices. I'm wearing glasses. I'm wearing hearing aids. By the time you reach my age, you've got many of these technological enhancements, if you will. But we can't be just seduced by that. It has to play a role in the bigger meaning seeking that we are engaged in. What is it that is meaningful for humans? What is the purpose of our lives? We need to be rethinking that and give place to technology and economics, etc. But realize that we are part of that bigger consciousness that is unifying.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. We hope you've enjoyed this program. To hear more from these guests, listen to their full interviews. These interviews were conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. This episode was produced by Mia Funk and Tom Logan. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.